This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Right now, a wave of book bannings is sweeping schools around the country. The examples are many, but the focus is clearly on how schools teach race and racism, whether acknowledging some of the realities of history is just too divisive. The political ramifications go well beyond the classroom. In the state of Virginia, to take one recent race, Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, made the alarm over critical race theory a cornerstone of his campaign for governor, which he won, even though CRT is not part of the state curriculum. And Ted Cruz made school library books a set piece in the confirmation hearings of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I find that statement a little hard to reconcile with the public record, because if you look at the Georgetown Day School's curriculum, it is filled and overflowing with critical race theory. Critical race theory, an introduction. They include the end of policing and an advocacy for abolishing police. They include How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi. They include literally stacks and stacks of books, and I'll tell you two of the ones that were most stunning. They include a book called Anti-Racist Baby by Ibram Kendi. Now, this is a book that is taught at Georgetown Day School to students in pre-K through second grade, so 4 through 7 years old. Do you agree with this book that is being taught with kids that babies are racist?
Senator, I do not believe that any child should be made to feel as though they are racist or though they are not valued or though they are less than, that they are victims, that they are oppressors. I don't believe in any of that. But what I will say is that when you...
But if this culture war is today's headlines, the dynamics have been around for a long time, at least a century. That's according to my colleague Jill Lepore, who's a staff writer and a historian at Harvard. Lepore sees the school's issue in light of another epic culture war, the fight over revolution in the 1920s. Jill, sometimes it seems that the work of a historian is to point out almost that it was ever thus. You just wrote a piece of reporting for us called Why the School Wars Rage, and you link the current wave of book banning in schools across the country to something that at first glance isn't necessarily an obvious connection, the Scopes trial, the so-called trial of the century a full 100 years ago. Jill, do you see a clear resonance between the Scopes trial and this debate over critical race theory and so much else?
I do. I think what draws together the anti-evolution campaigns of the 1920s, and we might think of them as the anti-racism campaigns of the 2020s, is a kind of battle between parents and the state. It's not like okay, we can say here's 1922 and here's 2022. And if we just take it like an accordion and press it together, it's going to make this beautiful noise of explanation. My point is, in the 1920s, what was hot in terms of being contestable about biology is the same thing that is now contestable about history. That is to say, as a basic model for how change happens, biology and history share a really similar intellectual architecture underneath. They're both explanations for change. But in the 20s, biology really just was just sparky. Everything you talked about, but it's the age of eugenics. Everything mattered. You know, post-Reconstruction, Jim Crow, what people are in the United States are fighting over, people are dying every day due to ideas about race and the fixity of categories of race. So when arguments come along about evolution, they're immediately deeply political and easily politicized.
In 1925, biology teacher John Scopes spiraled to fame in the legal battle that became known as the monkey trial. Whether man was descended from the monkey or just making a monkey out of man was fought in a courtroom that challenged the truth of the Darwin theory of evolution. The existence of man in the prehistoric world was denied.
And, well, you know, where humans come from, what happens after we die, like, of course that stuff's going to be sparky. So 100 years later, what are the sparks that are flying everywhere are in some ways kind of the same questions. You know, can people change? What does race mean? And then this big, big question about what's the relationship between parents' authority over their children and the state's authority over parents and children.
The press and public listened with unprecedented interest as the legal brains of both sides dug deeper and deeper into the conflicting theories of man's heritage. In this bitter legal engagement, the defense fought against the...
Well, for those of us who haven't, you know, watched Inherit the Wind lately or read a good biography of Clarence Darrow, tell us, give us the setting. What was the trial of the century and what were the sides? Who was pitted against whom?
So most people's understanding really does come from Inherit the Wind, if they haven't even if they haven't seen Inherit the Wind, which is the great, amazing Frederick March, Spencer Tracy, 1960 adaptation of the play. So the supposition that we get, I think, from watching that film or from, you know, most of your listeners have in mind is that there was the forces of modernism represented by Clarence Darrow, the great attorney for the damned, who strode into Dayton, Tennessee, and convinced the world. This was the first trial broadcast live on the radio. Everybody listened to it coast to coast. It's kind of incredible that that happened, but convinced everybody coast to coast that these yahoos, these hillbillies, were opposed to everything about modernity. They were opposed to science. They were opposed to Darwin, which was a basic scientific method. They were opposed to free speech. They were opposed to public discourse and public deliberation. They were superstitious. They were mystical. They were ignorant. And that this is not a trial about evolution or about John Scopes. It was a trial. Civilization itself is on trial. And opposed to Darrow and to Scopes and opposed to the ACLU and to modernism was fundamentalism. And it's really the first major battle of our culture war.
That's historian Jill Lepore. Our conversation continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
You write that the battle over public education that afflicted the 1920s has somehow started up again, this time over the teaching of American history. How are the circumstances the same or resonant at least, and how are they different, if at all?
First of all, mandatory public education was a progressive era crusade. And it was hard for a lot of people to take, hard for a lot of farming families, in particular rural families, and especially devoutly religious families. It was a progressive crusade for all the good reasons. It was good for children's health. It was good for the nation. It was good for the production of knowledge. It was good for providing, above all, for providing equal equality of opportunity to young people.
Who objected?
The people who objected at first were businesses that employed children. So, for instance, in the South, a lot of Southern textile owners did not want kids to go to school. And so some sort of big businesses used that argument to play on the fears of families, poor families with small farms, convincing them that if their kids had to go to school, they would lose their farm. When in fact, there was a whole progressive set of packages that were also designed to help those families keep their farms, right? And we also forget that at the time, compulsory vaccination was part of that same package. Even before the 1918 influenza pandemic, compulsory vaccination was accomplished by way of making schools compulsory. So you had to go to school. And in order to go to school, you had to be vaccinated. So it was kind of a whole package deal. So when people were objecting, by the 1920s, people are objecting to the teaching of evolution, they were actually objecting to a whole package of progressive reforms that included some things that we would absolutely find unsavory today. And one of them is the way that evolution was actually generally taught, which was as a kind of social Darwinism. The so-called feeble-minded and the criminal and the insane ideally should be sterilized. And we, you know, thankfully, evolution has taken, improved the human race through various iterations. And it's that kind of contempt for ordinary people, the contempt for the poor, the contempt for rural families, the contempt for people that disagreed with all of progressivism's other reforms was a big part of progressivism, and it is still today.
Now, one of the through lines of 100 years ago and today is this idea of parental rights. You heard it in the Scope situation. You heard it really loudly in Virginia. In fact, it's considered a great screw-up that Terry McAuliffe said parents shouldn't dictate what schools teach. And Glenn Youngkin jumped all over that. What are the parental rights and how do they play into the conversation? Let's concentrate first on the anti-evolution bills of the 1920s.
Yeah, so parental rights were really invented during the progressive era as an argument to use against progressive reforms that included compulsory vaccination, compulsory education, and the abolition of child labor. So parents could say, parents who didn't want those things could say, no, these are violating our parental rights. So it was a legal gambit. And it really, it didn't work. It didn't succeed ultimately, right? We have compulsory schooling everywhere, vaccination to some degree. So the parental rights arguments didn't work, but neither did they die out. And they surface again really in the 1950s after Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, in which the U.S. Supreme Court decrees that segregation in education is unconstitutional. And the argument that is made really immediately and is made in the run-up to that decision is that telling schools that they have to be desegregated, that they have to desegregate and integrate, is a violation of parents' rights. The problem is, the people who, segregationists who want to make that argument I think, this is just my theory, they also are making what they consider to be a states' rights.
Well, this is argument. It. States' rights sounds a lot like parental rights.
Right. So they decide, this is, I'm imagining some dark, smoky room where Strom Thurmond and James Eastlander, you know, smoking a cigar and saying, I know, let's call it school choice. But like, I don't know, somehow they decide to call it school choice because choice was the key word of the Cold War. Like in free societies, we have choice. And the unfree world doesn't have choice. So let's use choice. We'll call it school choice. So under the banner of school choice, they fought against school integration. And that lasted for decades.
Well, let's look at that. Today's book bannings aren't just about books. It's about critical race theory. It's about anti-racist language that became mainstream after the murder of George Floyd. It's about the 1619 Project. And arguably, it's about the way we think about the Trump era as a whole. When you listen to this debate and when you clue into it, whether it's on MSNBC or Fox News, how do you analyze it? And maybe perhaps through the prism of what you are telling us about the 20s, where are the vanities? Where are the errors? What are we not seeing about ourselves? And let the critique fall where it may on the progressive side or the conservative side.
Well, I think the conservatives are just trying to win elections on this issue. I actually doubt the sincerity of a lot of the people who are leading the charge on the conservative side. Like the idea that these various, you know, the 1619 Project or critical race theory or LGBTQ positive books are bad for our community because they divide our community. Therefore, we're going to divide our community by calling them bad. This is just bunk, right? So what's my analysis? I find that to be bunk. Now, not to say, like, I actually understand that many parents are kind of concerned about everybody's pays attention. If you're being a good parent, you're paying attention to what your kid's learning in school. Yeah, I don't fault parents who kind of get a little bit swept away in this. It's the kind of the political consultants who are devising these.
Jill, how much is this whole conversation about parental rights and how much of it is just about the midterm elections?
I think a ton of it is about the pandemic.
The pandemic? You think that's the thing?
I really do. I just think I think the anguish of parents over what the pandemic has meant for children and their own helplessness, our own helplessness in doing the parenting that is needed is a pretty considerable force at play in the world. It can be exerted in all kinds of good directions, thinking about different ways to help your community, help out your schools. But I think that great sort of pulling your children close, tucking them back into your family life inside the hard drive of your computer, watching over them in this new and different way and fearing for them, fearing even for their lives in a way you have not quite felt, and letting them back out into the world unmasked and vulnerable. I just feel like that runs through it all. And that's why we should forgive one another about people just being completely screwy in the head about what to do next. Like, I just think parents are still feeling like they're not doing enough. So I think there's that. And then there's the really, really creepy politicians who see what that is, who have the kind of political instinct, the kind of almost like animal instinct of a Donald Trump sort of person, the kind of, you know, the instinct that a Youngkin has or DeSantis has. Wow, that is this giant cloud of misery that I can just take a parachute and wrap it around that cloud of misery and just cinch it in, and I'm going to turn it into a hot air balloon and I'm going to rise politically from these people's misery. That's what I picture when I see this stuff.
You know, we've had conversations in the past and I always feel like I'm the one arguing for hysteria. This has never happened before. Something like Trump has never happened before. This has never happened before. And you're the one that edges toward, this has happened before. Don't freak out.
I think maybe the reason I write about history is that I'm the one who's always freaking out and I always need the fix that says, wait, calm down. This could be okay still. So I don't know that maybe I just am good at pretending to not be freaked out.
You're the voice of hope, Jill. Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
You can read Jill Lepore's essay, Why the School Wars Still Rage, at newyorker.com. She's also the author of These Truths, A History of the United States, and many other books. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.